Mr. Pritchard, as you know, we've previously interviewed several eminent scholars whose connections with the faculty extend back to the Second World War, and these are a valuable source of information on what was a time of great change. And you've been associated with the faculty for over 60 years, and I hope you'll be able to provide us with further reminiscences on this intriguing period. Also, as we talk about your own career, I'm sure you will give us many insights into the evolution of the teaching of law at Cambridge and the many personalities that you've met over the following half century during your time at Conville and Caius. And finally, I hope that we can visit some of your own research topics that I know include inter alia admiralty law and tort. So can we start by talking about your early life in pre-war England? You were born in 1927 in Banstead, Surrey, near Epsom.
Yes, that's true, yes.
Is this where you spent your childhood?
No, well, we moved from there fairly soon thereafter to Wimbledon, because with three brothers, the four of us, we all went to the Jesuit school, Wimbledon College. It's called a college, though it's really a school, but it's a college because all of the Jesuit schools are called colleges. But it it was a very leading sort of teaching, it's called a faith school today, but of course in those days it was just sort of a Jesuit school. And so we moved to Wimbledon, and then shortly before the war, just before the war, in fact, that's the Second World War, we moved back to Sutton, fairly close to Banstead, because my father, who'd been fairly gassed in the First World War, felt needed to live on, curious enough, chalk and high ground, and Wimbledon was a little too damp and low, so we moved back there. But it meant, of course, daily travelling across from Sutton all the way to Wimbledon, and during the war included, mostly. But before the war, I mean, also too, but vividly one remembers it during the war, travelling across each day. But,
was this a religious school?
It's Jesuit, yes. It, under the 1944 Act, they had to discuss it, because before that it had really been a private school, though, of course, Jesuit being Jesuit school, the fees were very low, and they weren't very low. But it became a sort of a maintained school in 1944, so that, but that was the Butler, you know, Education Act.
I was
there until 1945, in fact, and left in 45.
What subjects did you excel at, Mr. Pritchard?
Well, I don't know about excelling, but the one I tended to be on the on the literary side, arts side, rather than science side. I'd like to excuse myself on that I've always been interested in some of the science thing, that it was virtually impossible to get any scientific materials. For instance, chemistry, you could hardly any teaching during the war, because you simply couldn't get hold of chemists, so that I never took to that in the slightest. Physics tended to have to be more the mathematical side of statics and dynamics and the rest, rather than anything else. But it was mostly classics, and then in history and French. So at actual what was called school certificate level, it was all fairly equally, eight subjects we had to do, they were all fairly equal. And then one had to choose to go into, well, the Jesuits were very keen on going on to the classic side. They're not actually Latin and Greek. I mean, I continue to do Latin, but not, as a regret, that I never really mastered Greek. Latin came in very useful a little later, as we will see.
I gathered, during the war, that was it, you see.
I can still vividly remember we would travel over in the bus, and occasionally the bus would stop and we'd all have to get out and go for the nearest shelter. That was in the early years, yes, so in the bombs where, you know, so we were going across in the bomb. It's all right, nothing came very close to us. A few in Sutton was very close to where we were. It was up
very to, interesting.
Very close to Croydon Aerodrome. But,
you would have been 12 years old when war actually broke out.
Yes, yes. And it was really very, as it were, they were very impressionable years, those six years were, yes.
Yes.
Yes. I'm not doing any, but it rather messed up study a good deal. Even during the war, one was sort of, the sirens would go and when we go down to the shelters and the middle.
Incredible.
We decided, at the very beginning of the war, we had four of us. The eldest one was a territorial, so he was called up on the day, actually before war was declared. But the three of us, mother and father, agreed that since Dad would have to stay in London for his work, mother was very keen to stay there too, and preferred that we should all stay on the ground that we would stay or go together. So we weren't evacuated at all, and Wimbledon College wasn't evacuated, unlike many schools, because in fact it was felt that the Jesuits would stay there, and so they did. Yes, but,
were there any other deprivations that you recall?
Not. There were books were difficult, and things like exercise books and papers had to be kept fairly frugally because they weren't easily replaced. But no, I think we were probably healthier during the war, but we fairly, as it was, sparse rations.
Did you
much better, in fact, I think, yes.
But witness any serious bombing?
Nothing very much as at the school, no. I mean, the school didn't go get hit at all in the slightest, no. It was because we weren't over in the East End or anything at the moment in London. It was much more at night when it was much more over the whole of the city, but we were still on the suburbs, and I don't want to over dramatise it. But there was one or two fairly close, near enough at home. To blow out the windows of the houses, the glass from the houses. So my brothers and I tended to spend our evenings going around to houses, replacing wind panes of glass and things. But nothing dramatic at all. And I was too young to go in, just too young. I didn't get to my sort of medical for call up until early 45. In fact, effectively, when the war was virtually over by that time, and they decided they could do without me, that I should be more trouble medically to them than that. So I wasn't called up for National Service.
Did you feel that you'd been spared?
Well, no, not really. I think a bit disappointed in some ways, but because that was the sort of spirit. But very happy, really, to sort of, it meant that my father, very luckily, God got us into, or at least I got into King's College London. Actually, my elder brother, who was by that time not the eldest, who was serving throughout the war, and my second brother, Brian, who became a solicitor in London, he was still in the Navy. So curiously enough, although I was the third child, I was the first to go through King's London, and then Brian followed, and then Alan, who later became Professor of Law at Nottingham. We all read law at King's London immediately after the war, under Harold Potter.
Right.
And that's a slightly different experience.
Yes.
But a very vivid one, I may say. Yes. Do you want to move on to that one?
Well,
it's up to you.
Yes. Just before we do, in general, did the war affect your outlook on life in any way? I know that it did for Professor Allett. It had a fairly profound effect on the way he viewed the world.
I don't think so, no. I think I was fairly young, so it was all very exciting. I know that sounds ridiculous nowadays, but one would, as boys, one would plot the flow and the fallback of the German troops in Russia, so one learned a good deal of geography. apart from that, general worries, and of course my brothers were serving, but not really, no, I didn't think so. But it's at the age of a boy, at the age of sort of when I was 16, 17, much more interested in the that sort of thing, you know.
Yes.
And yes. No, but apart from that, not really, I don't think.
And when you moved to London, did you find that this was very different to where you grew up and had been to school? I mean, was London...
Oh, London, well, first of all, King's London, it was immediately after the war, and the whole place was still, and King's London was still badly damaged. That was in Somerset House, rather than that had been bombed, part of that. So, but King's was carrying on remarkably well, but in just the narrow eastern third of Somerset House, with the inland revenue on the Somerset, the main part of Somerset House. And lectures and supervisions were very packed into a small space.
It must have been a strange mix, because you had a lot of these people returning from the war who were much more experienced.
Yes, in the first year there were very largely actually prisoners of war returning, including those from the Far East. But there were quite a lot of those, yes. And wartime and people from the services. I was relatively one of the young ones. Not the only one, there were others too who had come up, you see. Because at that stage, they didn't really want a lot more. National service, it tended to come in a little bit later here at this stage, 45. They were mostly trying to cope with the large number of people who needed demobilisation.
Right.
But yes, it was really, I should perhaps explain, King's London was where really the teaching was very much organised with two other colleges, University College London and LSE. So we would have to travel between the three for lectures. I still remember you would get on a bus to go up to, as it were, the godless institution of Gower Street, which is how we refer to University College, but one would have some lectures there. But it had the enormous advantage that one got lectures from all the very good the law professors, the outstanding people in London, not just in King's London. So that if I could just rattle through them a bit, you see, I can still vividly remember them all. In fact, one does tend to remember things at that age. It's an exciting change. It's law, it's the first thing, it's a completely new subject to one, and one doesn't trip. But at King's itself, I was the dean of the faculty was Harold Potter. I'll come back to him, who, as it were, instilled in all us boys, I think, a sort of love of the law, as it were, just not so much technical brilliance, but rather just passionate interest in law and what it should do for society. And so there was Harold Potter, and he had a relatively small but very hard-working staff. There was Albert Caralfi, and there was Noakes on evidence and things, quite a number. And supervisions tended, of course, to be, they weren't supervisions like Cambridge, they were all in eights and tens, and they were really just groups who were looking at puzzles or problems, you know, and cases and discussing cases. But I remember the one who would drive us hardest in supervision later, only came for a year from Oxford, where he'd been using him, was Fleming. And then Fleming and myself, when Fleming returned as Good Heart Professor, we had some very pleasant times chatting about what life was like then. But I do remember, if I can say that, some lecturers would come and be in King's, for instance, Potter's, they were in King's. David Hughes Parry would come over from London School of Economics, which really just showed how hard people were pressed in those days, because he was also Vice Chancellor of the university, but at the same time a full-time professor and lecturing like any other professor.
Was that Clive Parry?
But Hughes Parry. But he would come over and lecture, and his lectures were always extremely clear. Potter's lectures weren't clear, but they were exciting. But to give you some flavour of it. I mean, he would lecture on land law, and there was no question of, as it were, concessions to the weak. The first lecture was really upon modern types of ownership, and the second one, though it won't mean much to anything else, was on the powers of the estate owner under the Settled Land Act, and that was my second lecture on land law. Well, for anybody who knew land law or knows the history of land law at all, the powers of the Settled Land and the owner under the Settled Land Act are not the easiest topic for the secondary. Yes, particularly when they were concerned with raising money. But that was the second lecture. Then we also had, I should mention them straight off, is two we had. At London School of Economics, we had Glanville Williams. I'll return to him for a moment, in a moment. But he was there. And the other one who sticks out in my mind, well, two at University College. There was George Keaton on equity. But the one who really sticks in my mind from there was Professor Jolovitz. That's Tony's father.
Right.
Was sort of quite a remarkable scholar and taught us Roman law and taught me all the Roman law I ever knew, because he was really a quite exceptional lecturer and very keen and extremely conscientious in his lectures and everything. For years I used to rely on his notes entirely, in fact. Then for third year we returned to him and he gave me the best lectures I ever attended on jurisprudence.
Goodness.
It was more on the historical side.
Yes.
I tended, that seems, to like the historical side.
He'd been in intelligence.
Yes, he had. Yes. I didn't know that at the time. But you see, all of them were coming back. For instance, Ronald Graveson, when he came back to King's, had to lecture in his army uniform for the first few,
really?
Few lectures, because he hadn't got his demob clothes. I mean, they came straight back out and straight into lecturing. I mean, he was a reader at that stage. And we also had one very nice person called Kitson, who was an RAF pilot who had been blinded in the RAF, so his wife had to come and sit with him while he lectured. But he unfortunately didn't stay in the lecturing. He was very good, very conscientious, but since he really needed an amanuensis, and the King's London couldn't afford that, he went into the civil service. But you see, I have an admiration for these people, an affection for these people, because they were pitchforked into it, you know, at the deep end. If you can pitchfork somebody into the deep end, they were tossed in at the deep end. And it really, very few of them had been there during the war. Some had, but not, and the older ones had. But some were coming back. There we are. The young one I've just ended was Glanville Williams, and he was at London School of Economics. I was lucky enough to have him in the first year lecturing on constitutional law, and he was remarkably good, quite remarkably good. And then in the second year I was even more fortunate to have him into criminal law, and it still is quite exciting to remember, as it were, how one became aware of the distinction between intention and recklessness and negligence and things, you know, concepts like this. But they're all very precisely and clearly expounded. Just as in constitutional law, my first acquaintance with Venn diagrams was Glanville Williams explaining the non-separation of powers in this country. But in constitutional law, of course, in those days, you see, the third term was still devoted quite to what now would be almost unintelligible to people. It was still devoted to the Empire and Commonwealth. And so where Glanville was extremely good was on the difference of the constitutions of Canada and the constitutions of Australia. But of course, that's fairly soon the whole of the Commonwealth changed, but that was one third term of the...
Really?
In college we were lucky enough to have Hood Phillips, actually, who had actually done, curiously, a work here in Cambridge with Wayden Phillips on constitutional law. So we were really very lucky there, but as I say, Glanville Williams turned you know, when he did a subject, it was quite interesting. When he was asked to lecture on a subject, or became later, for instance, Quain Professor of Jurisprudence, he would write a book on the subject, more or less, and then start off the criminal law one. He would switch from constitutional law to criminal law before he had time to write a book on constitutional law.
Interesting.
But on criminal law, of course, the early lectures, and without the slightest disrespect to him, he later became very much more concerned with the penal side of it and the effects of it, which are excellent, you know. But for first year, for lawyers, young, starting off, when he was very purely concerned with analysing the concept of the criminal law, they were very, very... So while I was at London, I was really rather privileged to have these.
Absolutely. You know,
they're the eminent scholars I remember from just after the war.
Well, I'm fascinated by what you say, particularly the module in constitutional law that focused on Australian constitutional law.
What a far
cry from today. I mean, we seem to have moved so far away.
But also, too, you say you had to deal with the difference between protectorates and dependencies and crown colonies and things of this sort, because they were all there, you see. But as regards the constitutional law itself, it was very much more, of course, constitutional law hadn't yet really changed in the sense that judicial review had not really developed. We still had the old royal orders of mandamus and certiorari. But they hadn't been, as it were, changed into judicial review, which was 10 years later.
I'm wondering, Mr. Pritchard, what prompted you then to apply to do an LLB at Queen's?
Ah, yes. In fact, I'd done rather well in the examinations there at London, and Harold Potter saw that I was sort of quite interested on the academic side, much more interested on the academic side, and it was he who persuaded me to apply for the Cambridge LLB. It was all a question for a long time. It was a question of whether one could possibly afford it, because there's no question in those days you had grants to go to university. You paid your own fees. We didn't, mother and father had four or three of us, as it were, or four of us in actual fact. But luckily I managed to get enough scholarships from various places. King's were very, very good. I got a postgraduate scholarship there, and they allowed me to hold it at Cambridge. I was at Gray's Inn by that time, because Harold Potter sent all his King's people to Gray's Inn. They gave me a scholarship there, studied law. And then, in fact, my first contact with Cambridge was that Harold Potter suggested I sort of get in touch with Emlyn Wade, who was a great friend of Harold Potter. And Emlyn became very interested and got me to apply for a Squire Law Scholarship. I remember the first letter I ever got from the faculty was one from Kurt Lipstein, who was, in fact, I've still got the letter, telling me that I had been awarded a Squire Law Scholarship, over £60 a year, but it made all the difference. And that was my first communication from the faculty. So I came up to Queen's because Emlyn Wade and Harold Potter suggested I should try and go to Queen's, where Arthur Armitage was there. He was very dynamic in the lead. So I went up to Queen's to meet the LLB. That was 2 years. You had to do 2 years for any degree in Cambridge. So you took the exam in 1 year, and the next year you did some research. But you had to... Others later sort of repeated by doing the tripos. They repeated what they'd done at King's at London, and then did the LLB in the second of the 2 years. But that was thought to be not really quite the right way to spend the year when I was there, so we went straight to the LLB, and I was at Queen's then. It was too late being applied because I only got my results in London in sort of July in 1945, and I came up in 1948. Actually, I'm in 45 to 48. I was at King's London. I joined Belgium in July 48, and then so that I had to make my application to get in. Kurt working as always during the summer, as it was still hard at work in August and September. In September, I wrote and said I could have, you know, could have this Squire scholarship. And Arthur Armitage at the last moment managed to find me a room to get me to Queen's. But of course, I couldn't live in college in Queen's because it was all full by that time. So I went up to Queen's for 2 years. And it was a very, the real staggering difference between going to London and coming to Cambridge, I can still remember it, was that the day was 3 hours longer, straight away. The day was 3 hours longer, because you see, in London, no lecture could start before 10 at the earliest, to allow, it was an hour and a half to travel up to London in the immediately after the war, the bus interruption. So you would leave soon after 8 in order to get for a 10 o'clock lecture. And no lecture went on, no supervision or anything, went on beyond 3:30, because students had to get, on the whole bit, well, it might go on to 4 o'clock, but you needed to get away before the ordinary workers of the, because the traffic became so jammed. It was all jamming on buses and undergrounds. And they had to get home, because many of them lived out. I mean, for instance, out in Berkhamsted, and then Potter lived out in Royston, or near Royston. and then you came up to Cambridge and found, they were literally is the wrong word, but they were sort of 3 hours extra a day for students. I mean, you could study in the Squire Law Library up until just before 7, and then walk round to back hall in Queen's.
Was that delightful, Mr.
Prickett? Oh, it was just a complete change. It meant one had time in the library, whereas at King's London, one had very little time in the library. almost all you had to see, most of your information had to come from lectures and supervision. You had many cases you had to take on trust. There'd only be the odd copy, it's with short and things. And that's why one came to appreciate very much lecturers like Dolowitz and Neville Williams, who put an enormous amount of time on their lectures, and so to make sure they were good. But while I'm still down in London, I remember with Glanville Williams, I was extremely impressed at that time as a young man. He was not a great sense of humour in lecture or anything like this, you see, but he encouraged questions, but they had to be genuine questions. If it was just show-off questions, he would put them down very much. But if it was a genuine question, he would stop the lecture and write a note, a careful note, that this was a point which had caused genuine concern. The result is that after about 2 or 3 years, his lectures had ceased to be the stuff that might bore us all, because we got in, but it was the points which might trip us up or anything, so that, more and more came into the lectures of what was upsetting the student, or what was puzzling the student. And of course they got better and better for that reason. I was extraordinarily always impressed with that. He would always stop and make a note of it, and not just sort of deal with it. He would always deal with it. But he, or say, I'll come back to this one, because sometimes he said, we're going to deal with this. It transformed the lectures in the course of about 2 or 3 years. The one he gave his 3 years after he gave his first one, type of thing, had changed quite remarkably, because they were good to start with, but the first ones, one was writing down very much, because what would now be the textbook stuff, and 3 years later, you see, well, he would be lecturing on the points that trouble the student.
almost like the beginnings of a case-based approach.
Well, yeah, but it wasn't necessarily case-based. No. It was just explaining a concept or something like this. Yes, no, and it was very good. But there we are. Yes. But coming back to Cambridge, you see, I mean, it was totally different. I mean, supervisions were different. Not that we had any supervision in the LLB, and there weren't very many lecturers at that stage. It was a fairly lonely existence in that sense, because two papers on legal history, and there wasn't any, and then it did administrative law, which was with M. Len Wade, and comparative English and Roman law, or transfer of movables, as well as under J.W.C. Turner. And those were four papers, but there was no supervision at all. But one was lucky at Queen's, because there were three other extraordinarily good students at the time, exactly the same, not doing my subjects, nobody else did it. But it was Bill Wedderburn, who was there at Queen's doing the LLB at my time, and there was David Widdicombe, who later became MP for Widdicombe, Widdicombe for Widdicombe, and then there was Newey, John Newey, who later became a master of the Hanging. And they were all very good, there were four very good, all of us, you see. So Queen's had quite a good, you know, Arthur Armitage had got us a very nice, good stable of people there at that stage. So that was very great fun, and very, very, they were interesting, and it meant that in meetings of the Cambridge, of the Queen's Bench, was very interesting. They still stick in my mind. We used to meet in Arthur's room. So yes.
You met in Arthur Armitage's room?
Room over in, yes, before in the evening. So right. If it was, sometimes it was larger and we would have to go into a hall or something like this. Any but Arthur would still, you see, they, you know, in those days they, you know, he was back, of course, he'd come back in 45 at the time when I was at King's London, but he'd been away during the war, of course, too, you see. Like so many of them, Dick Goodis, John Thorne, so they were all the, if you like, the returning ones after the war. They were the older ones who had stayed in Cambridge. Yes, but the LLB was quite it was an interesting period.
Who were your mentors during this period, Mr. Pritchard?
Well, one was mostly, the LLB was very largely left to oneself, right. Very largely left right. to oneself. Harry Holland did the legal history lectures, though in fact, actually, again, just as Glanville Williams' lectures at London stood out, and so did Harold Potter's, but they stood out particularly, Glanville's and Potter's at London, at Cambridge. I do remember I was privileged to attend Toby Milsom's first lecture. He was just back as a research fellow at Trinity, and they were trying him out for lectures, and I attended his first lectures action on the case, which was very exciting, because it was totally new, totally different from everything we'd learned beforehand. Everything in all that, you know, action on the case wasn't action in like a case, and it was action quite totally different approach to it. I remember that was very exciting. Taking the LLB examination was really quite amusing, because in those days, in that time, we had an extraordinarily good provision in the rubric for the examination was answer up to four questions, but whether you answered one or four was entirely left to you. And I do remember one of the legal history papers, and I spent the whole 3 hours writing on action on the case. But I still remember Toby's lectures.
He inspired you.
Oh, yeah, legal history. I was already interested in legal history very much, because I've been in history, been the main subject at school, in fact. Yes. Now, they were in a little room called Room 7 in the square, down in the old law school. That was the small one. The first of the ones I think we lost to some coffee room or something for the staff. It's the downstairs of the lift, the lift in the Regent House. But no lectures were all there, of course.
Toby Mawson would have been about 26 years old at the time. He was born in
26 years. But great fun, and he's a great lecturer in that sense.
He's a lovely man.
There was a totally different type of lecturer. They were always put very tentatively, and not stutteringly, but hesitantly. But you could see the mind at work, as it
really?
Were. Very
and
good.
It was fun.
That was it really was fun.
In fact, I could just interpret that one a year later, or 2 years later,
I used to go to his lectures, even though I'd taken the exam and finished, I would always go along to his lecture. I remember the Harry Holland sort of had arranged for him, you know, he was giving his lecture. And that morning, it was going to be on the Court of Exchequer, in the time of Henry II and Henry III. He was going to give this lecture. It was just a standard lecture, into something he was working on. And Harry, his friend Jenkinson, Sir Hilary Jenkinson, was up in Cambridge, so he was going to come to the lecture. Now Hilary Jenkinson had written the book on select peas on select peas on the Exchequer, and so you were going to lecture to the man in the morning. And I would have to say, but Toby with lecture notes on the Exchequer in front of him, sort of switched his subject at the last moment onto the King's Bench. And I remember his revealing afterwards, he said, I hope that wasn't. But he didn't, quite rightly, he didn't dare lecture on the King. But there we are, yes. They were fun, as it were. They were good fun, yes.
Mr. Bridgewell, you use the word fun, and that crops up, that word. I don't know how many times in the interviews I did with Toby.
Oh, yeah.
And that it was very important to him, I think, in
his appreciation of life. It was a fun time, anyway. I mean, any argument or dispute or trying to work out what happened, because it was largely detective work. We got a similar sense of, not quite fun, but excitement and intense from Harold Potter, too. They were very exciting that way. As I say, Glanville was in a much more purely intellectual way. It was exciting rather than fun, but with Toby it was fun. Fun all the way. But not in a light heart, you know. Yeah. I mean, very, very. But that was the LLB. Well, I think what I remember at Queen's was, because sometimes people have asked, and you may well ask, well, how do you fit in from what we call just a, not really even a grammar school boy, but a day school boy from London coming into Cambridge? Well, it was actually quite, I suppose I was lucky in a way, in the sense that, of course, many of my colleagues were ex-service, they were straight demobbed, and at that stage, you know, they were given places at the university, so that Queen's was, I never had the slightest feeling that one was a sort of, you know, lower working class boy or something. There was no class distinctions, it was very striking, looking back, one puts it very much on the fact that it was, the Queen's was at that stage, we were completely full of people from all sorts of different backgrounds who had served in the forces, because most of them, the great many of them, were youngsters, not much older than myself, but a little bit older, some of them, and they had they'd come from all walks of life beforehand. Yes. No, those were very good days at Queen's.
Sixty years ago you first came to Cambridge.
No, 63 years ago.
63 years.
Well, 19 1948.
Well,
64 years now, isn't it?
A hugely different place to today.
In some ways, life was hugely different, I think, rather than the place. Like, I can't really, you know. I think there was far less, well, looking ahead, because I went from Queens to Keene in 1950, straight away as a fellow of the college. There was less specialisation, much less specialisation. There were people who were outstanding distinguished in their own subject, but lecturers, for example, as in London, you know, they lectured on what they had to lecture on when they came up, when they came back from the forces and the rest. And, you know, one of the things the chairman of the faculty and the secretary had to do was organise the lecture list. And, you know, they had to decide somebody's got to lecture on this subject. And, yes, I may say that when I went over to Keyes as a fellow in 1950, I hadn't got the university post until the following year, I think. But in the college, I mean, there were about, I think, not the first year, but the second year, there were 50 students. And because they'd been moved, some had been doing 2 years, economics for the first year, and then law and the rest, but there were 50. There was nobody else, as it were, so one did the teaching or got weekenders to do it.
Right.
So you turn, you learn quite a lot by having to learn the subject the night before, but teach them the supervision, as it were. Yes, and that happened at university level too. I mean, people like they were very rarely, unless they were at professorial level or readership level, able to lecture on the subject they were really keen on.
There were
relatively few of them. People like John Thornley and Mickey Dias. Mickey Dias in particular would be called on to do almost anything.
Really,
I may say that when I got my assistant lectureship, they decided that they wanted a lecturer in the LLB course on transfer of movables. Of course, you might say I'd taken the course before, but then they decided to switch it to, as it were, negligence in English and Roman law. They said, well, you know, you did Roman law. And so from having done a one-year course on, first-year course on Roman law, luckily, with
Jolovich's
father Jolovich there down in London, to be switched to using that for LLB lectures, and particularly, as I still remember to my horror, in the audience was Geoffrey Wilson, who had just got the George Long Prize for Roman law and everything else, and he would sit in the back, like this, you see. Well, he's a Queen's man, it was fun, but that's what happened. I mean, I'm not playing them myself, but I mean, everybody had to switch from one subject to another, it just weren't all that many. But the faculty for many years, I suppose, it's very different from now, of course, but for many years, it was the Squalor Library was the heart and soul of the place. And moving on from 48, you know, Queens to Queens to Keys, the Squalor Library, the old Squire, which you will remember, or do you remember it?
Just
the upstairs, the old Squire, not the downstairs. The downstairs was the History Library, but all the law lectures took place in very nice lecture rooms in the old schools, with wood benches which had been put in just before the war.
Really?
So in fact, looking back on that, but I didn't realise at the time, it just looks as if the law faculty had always been there, but they had only been there for about 5 years, 4 years, 5 years, but 4 years, before the Second World War. So the people like Kurt and all the others remembered it when it was in the Downing Street site, the Museum of Ark and Ants. Over there, but I don't remember that at all. But the Squire, it all seemed home, as it were. But also, it was, looking back, a little, as it were, not sadly, but it was fondly. The faculty was very much a sort of a closely knit body, even though we all had colleges. Right. And the most of the faculty would try and get in for tea in the morning at 11 o'clock. As many lectures would be 9 till 10, from 10 till 11, and then 11 to 12. I mean, not all of them, by any means, but, and consequently, those who were lecturing from 10 to 11 would come in at 11 until just stay there for tea for about 10 past before they went back to their colleges. And those who were going to lecture at 11 would come in about 10 too. But others who had been upstairs would always come down. I mean, Kurt, for instance, who was inevitably up in room 5. I'll come back to him in a moment. But room 5 in the upstairs squire, he'd come down for tea. And that was where really most of the faculty business was done. And one would talk about the latest case or the argument, and visitors to the faculty would come too. And that took place in the old lecturer's combination room, which was right down, later became, I think, lecture room 2 or 3, and down in the downstairs. It was always tea, and made out of an enormous great pot by the lady cleaner, to clean. But it was, you know, it was good, because I remember people like Bill Wedderburn would always come in. One could always argue a case with him, and he was always very good at that. He was young, he liked myself. Pardon?
This was when you were lecturing, Mr. Pettigrew, rather than a student.
Yes, this is after 50. Before 48 to 50, yes. One was just a student, yes. One went to lectures and things. It was still in the same place,
yes.
And the lectures were still about. But 50 onwards, Herr Schlauterpacht would always be, nearly always be up in his room 6 in the old squire. Almost every day would come in very early, and Kurt would be in 5. But they were always very good at coming down, and others would be there. And many would come along from other colleges. I'm not saying necessarily from the furthest flung colleges, but they were very good at coming. I mean, they would come along from John's, Jackson would come along, Bailey would come along, later Scott, Ken Scott. And that kept going, you see, so that John Hall, for example, jumping ahead for years. That kept going for quite a long time, the whole of the 50s, really, and the early 60s. In the middle of the 60s, the coffee tradition took over, and since the lady cleaner couldn't really cope with coffee, which because it had to be fairly, couldn't stand getting stewing as if the tea could, because the younger members of the faculty tended to drift off into the Regent House upstairs for coffee. And so the tea habit rather broke down. But in the early days, I remember people like Jack Hampson would always come in, and Kurt would come down. They would come almost as a matter of course. So that the faculty as well had a sort of collegiate spirit as well as a college. In fact, I think we were probably better organised as a faculty. No, not better organised, the wrong word, but more cohesive as a faculty than most of the other faculty, arts faculties. Not the science faculties, of course, because they all had their laboratories and departments, and then chemistry within the chemistry building and so on and so forth. But whereas history tended to be scattered, because history didn't have a similar, although it had the ceiling, history library below us in the old schools, none of his lectures were there. Before the war, Harry Holland and McNamara McNair had organised that the law faculty would get the old schools. They were lovely lecture rooms. When the university library moved to the over the river to the big building, we shared it with the administration. And we had all our lectures there, and the administration hadn't started to trespass and encroach in a way. That really came with the 60s, but the 50s were very much that of a, yes,
This would have been the period from 1950
to about 60 sort of approach, I'm thinking of. That was the period when, as it were, it was still a small, fairly compact faculty. I remember, you know, excellent. Although some of the chants had retired by that time. I remember when I was, but that's where I was. Percy Winfield was still there.
Really?
By that time he'd retired. But I remember his last few lectures, but because I used to go to them when I was, but that was only when I was a student.
Yes.
But most of the, it was still a fairly small faculty, and it was still very much in the law. It was the law school. I never talked about the old schools, I talked about the law school,
right,
as it were. And, for example, the criminology, which is now a building of its own and has been there, used to be in a tiny little room, the whole of criminology kept in a tiny little room, up on the the west end of the North Gallery in the Squire Law Library.
Goodness.
If you ever saw that room, it's now used as a store, little storeroom, and a tiny window. But that was where it was, you see, because of course it started up there because J.W.C. Turner was still very largely concerned with it. Radzin just arriving, and then it started to expand and develop.
Yes.
But that was the 50s, yes.
And Mr. Pritchard, did you decide at that stage, when you, after you graduated, that you wanted to become an academic?
It was a very tempting offer. I mean, I think I would have. I was torn between that and practice. I have to say, I think I would have been. I would claim in a moment that I was lucky in some ways to have both. But no, I was offered a fellowship while I was still a student at Queen's, and Keyes Fellowship. It was really rather nice to live in and to live in college for the first time. So I became a fellow in the college. I got my university post rather rapidly after that. But I should say straight away that even though I was the only law fellow at the time, because of course Evelyn Wade was professor, so Arnold McNair had retired, though he was still very much a figure in Cambridge, having come back. He'd come back from Liverpool where he was Chancellor, so he didn't come back to a chair at all, because by that time Perch Hartmann had his chair. Hirsch and...
Sorry, Mr. Pritchard, just
the
window.
Sorry,
just a bit noisy from the students.
Emlyn and Arnold, and very strongly Arnold, were extremely good, because they persuaded the college that the law dean of the college ought to have, as well, some sort of professional. He ought to. I was already a member of the bar, the Gray's Inn, but he said, no, you should go and have some experience. So even though I held a fellowship, the college, entirely on their persuasion, and they were very persuasive people, particularly Arnold McNair, I was very sorry, the college allowed me to do my teaching, and it had to be 12-hour supervision a week in those days. And, at the weekend, and spend the week down in Chambers in London, reading in Chambers, and I had the particular privilege of spending a whole year. It was supposed to be 6 months, but in 6 months in equity and 6 months, 6 months in chancery, 6 months in common law, but we stayed the whole 12 months in, and I had the great privilege of being under John Brunyate, who was counsel. He was very disabled and he couldn't hardly walk, but he had a brilliant mind. He'd been a fellow, a mathematician at Trinity. He'd been a very distinguished prize fellow at Trinity and written the work on charity. But he was the great intellectual in the Chancery Division. He didn't go into court much, and he wasn't a QC because he couldn't get about much. He was very disabled, but he was deferred to very much by counsel. So I very lucky they got me into, as John Brunyate's pupil in Lord Upjohn's chambers for stone buildings. I'll mention that for a particular reason. And it was a very happy year there. Fortunately, my parents were still living not in Sutton, they moved to Epsom at that stage. So that during the week I could go and stay there at night and just come back and teach at the weekends.
It was quite a lot to teach.
But then it was quite, yes, it was very pleasant. But mostly because I may not have done well at the bar, but I would have enjoyed the life. The life was very, very much the same, particularly in a Chancery Chambers like Fortestone Buildings, where it was, again, they would have tea in the afternoon and they would discuss some problem, obviously not professional competence or anything, but some intellectual problem which would have arisen, as it were, and they would toss it around chambers. And occasionally Upjohn, who'd gone to the bench, would come back for tea and say, was I all right today? And he would ask John, was I right this morning? Which is rather amusing. You see, they all rather sort of assume that they must pass. Yes, so that I think I would have been as happy. And they were, they were quite keen to keep me, as it were. But I'd only got the year off from Keys. I think that was 52, 53, something. And I got my lectureship by that time, so that it was fairly heavy.
Yes. Goodness.
But going back to the faculty, you see, I don't think people didn't work as hard in the sense that they weren't rushing around so much. But they spent the hours enormously. For example, you see, everybody would have to, most people would supervise a lecture on the Saturday morning. In fact, two sets of lectures were always given. I mean, Roman Dutch law, which we used to teach, was always given on Saturday morning.
Do you remember who taught that?
Well, the one who sticks in my mind was a bit later because I had to organise one. It was Coulson. Coulson did the Roman Dutch law. And then for a number of years we had Scots law, and that was Ashton Cross, who used to come down from Scotland. But that would be on Friday afternoons and Saturday morning. But so Scottish law sticks in my mind because, of course, if it used to attract a number of Scots down. There are quite a number of Scots in the faculty . And they used to do Scots law. Tony Weir, I think, took over the lectures on it. I have to say, we always thought Scots was going very, very well, because they would do 1 year's Scots law, as it were. They were supposed to do five subjects per year with the tripos. We always thought it was a bit of a fraud that one paper was introduction to contract and tort, the second paper was contract, the third paper was tort. The fourth paper was Scots Law of Contract, and the fifth paper was the Scots Law of Tort. So they, in fact, they got away with two subjects, contract and tort, whereas everybody else had to do five very different subjects. But there we are. That's Simon, I used to pull Tony Weir's leg on this one.
That reminds me of someone I wanted to ask you about who came in 1949, and that was Peter Stein. He was at, of course, your college at Golden Keys.
He was earlier than that as an undergraduate, wasn't he? I think he graduated by 48, I think, because he wasn't my student. Peter was always senior to me in this, but I'd have to look him up. But he came to do the he came back to do the LLB, but not in. Not in residence, I don't think. He was there. Sorry, he may have been at Queen's at 40. May have been at Keys at 49.
Keys in
49 to 50.
Yes.
But that's right. Sorry, yes. But that was to do the LLB, wasn't it? He'd already done the tripos because he'd been the star pupil of David Dauber.
That's right.
But he'd gone in 1950 by the time that I went to Keys. And said, I was a queen, and I'd done the LLB, so wasn't doing it in the same year. I'd finished 40 in 49. I think he came up in October. He came back in October 49 at Keys. But there was no link between us, because his subjects for the LLB were different from mine.
Oh, I see.
His was he was doing the LLB in the same year as David Yale, whom, of course, I got to know quite very well, because he did the legal history option. and I had a lecture to him. But he went off to Aberdeen, didn't he?
He did, Nottingham first,
and then on to Aberdeen. Nottingham for a couple of years, because he overlapped with my brother when my brother went there, in fact, slightly to Nottingham, and then he went off to Aberdeen. Yes, no, he was the star pupil. I should, by the way, have mentioned, of course, he was no longer a fellow at the college, but David Dalber was a key. His college was Keyes, and he took some very bright people for me in Roman law. But he would only take very bright ones with David.
Do you remember him?
Oh yes, very well, yes. David. Yes. Oh yes, very well indeed. He was very serious, very evident, and of course I could be particularly interested in his work because when I was doing Nicholson's English and Roman Law, the article which had, as it were, made him well known in Roman Law on the Lex Aquilia, was essential to those lectures. He hadn't got a fellowship because he wouldn't do any teaching, so the colleges wouldn't give him wouldn't extend his fellowship. He had come over and been very largely brought over just before the war as a refugee, and by Buckland had made sure who was a Keyes man, and Buckland was at that stage the president, vice master of the college, and very senior, he was in his 80s and things in prison. And he had got him a fellowship at Keyes. That was before the war. But it went on, it was extended as long as we could possibly extend research fellowships. But he didn't really qualify for a teaching one because he was not willing to do 12 hours teaching, in all subjects.
Yes. Which does sound quite arduous, actually.
Oh, it was arduous, yes. It was arduous, but the undergraduates were far less demanding, far, far less demanding than they are now.
Yes.
They didn't want to be, as it were, spoon-fed. I don't wish to run down the prison undergraduate, but they do expect everything to be laid out on a plate, and that was not the case then. Students did not expect it in the slightest, particularly the ones who were coming back. And then, but many of them, you see, were older than I was when I was first at Queen, when I first became a fellow. I started teaching at Keyes the year before in that gap year when I still had to be a member of Queen's to qualify for the LLB. That's 49 to 50, I came across and supervised, but many of them were older, quite naturally, of course, they'd been in the forces. But as it were, they had proper feeling for how much time should be spent on study and how much time on life. And generally speaking, you see, nobody taught between 2 and about 5. The witching age, that was sport, as it were. And then 5 to 7, 5 to 6, 6 to 7, 2 hours solid. And the morning tended to be in the square and in lecture rooms there, and you expected undergraduates to go to lectures, and there were lots of them, and they would go through 4 of them, at least 3 a morning, you see. Lots of lectures they would go to. But supervisions tended to be, I probably underdid it as it were, I didn't drive them nearly hard enough. But not having had much writing to do before during the war, of course, at school and the rest, I never really acquired the habit of doing supervision. Well, never done any supervision essays and things myself. There were more discussions. And I think that would be true, generally speaking, all round. One wasn't expected to have spent the whole of the evening before reading the latest case, as it were.
And so exam centred.
Yeah, it was exam, yes. I think the exams were as tough then. They could be very tough. I mean, some of the papers Toby could set some tough ones, believe it or not. In English law, and not just, he was always very good there, but he wrote English law, and they could be fairly tough on their examining, but it was just, there wasn't the same panic about exams, because frankly, almost most of the students said, well, the first are for those who want to become academics, you know, and the rest, they were perfectly happy with 2-1s, or even thirds, as it were. Yeah. They were, you know. I'm not saying they weren't bright, as it were, but it wasn't desperate for them. People didn't attach to, you know, just to classes in the exam the same.
No.
I mean, it was very nice if they got first and first and stood out and starred, but that wasn't what really counted. Yeah, and the bar didn't really expect everybody to get, you know, either a first or 2-1. And there wasn't that. They what they wanted were sort of people who could argue and present a case so that was it, you see. And so there wasn't the examination pressure, no.
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 Different world.
It was a different world, yes. And they were, and they didn't expect things to be sort of, they weren't so spoon-fed. Though, to be frank, I have to say, what was carried on after the war, believe it or not, was sort of the university press would print some of the lectures to be handed out, you know, actually print them, the university press, on a sheet of the headings and title and references.
Really?
And so you've got them ready, and they were printed by the university press before and handed out at the lecture. Oh, yes, you know, real, very full, and that had virtually stopped by my time, but then I found that quite staggering.
Yes.
It's all like later when cyclostyle, you know, things were cyclostyle and Xerox and all that came in, but for a long period we didn't get that at all. Of course, there was nothing. There was no Xeroxes at all, and the old handwritten duplicators very, very appropriate. But I do remember that some of the very early lectures, people like Winfield and Holland still expected their lectures to be the headings to, and in any case references.
Yes.
To be done out,
Were you ever taught by, you wouldn't have been taught by Holland?
I was taught by Holland. Oh, well, he lectured to me.
Right.
He was not the most inspiring me. You know, he wasn't a lively person at all. He was very punctilious. He had an enormous influence in the universities, and for the rest of my life I've been spending realizing just what a part he played in the transformation of the university under the Royal Commission in 1923. I mean, he was acted as secretary of that commission, having had a distinguished war record. And most of college statutes, some of which are still the, you know, and the wording, you couldn't improve on them. He drafted them, and he and Arnold McNair had an enormous amount to do, assisting Sir Hugh Anderson and people like that. I'm not sure that people quite realise just how much he did in setting up the structure of the university and the colleges in the interwar years. But he was virtually retiring. He could almost reach retirement by the time that I came up. And he was an extremely conscientious lecturer, but not a lively one. No, exact opposite of where he was. No, he was not a very lively lecturer, in fact. But then, nor was Winfield wasn't either. In fact, you see, they weren't lively in that sense. Some were lively. I mean,
were you ever taught by
Arthur Armitage? Was lively. Jack Hampson, of course. He didn't talk, but I mean, we discussed a great deal. Oh yes, he was a very live wire in the faculty in that 50-60 period and 60-70 period. Yes, yes, he was lively. Yes. All this time, I should say, we're talking mostly about the 50-60. But of course, Kurt was not a fellow of a college at that stage. He hadn't been gone there. He was still what it was called a lector in Trinity, you see. But Trinity had got a number of fellows from inside, and a large number. They got Holland, they got Milsom, they got Wade, and then Tony Jolowitz and Ellie Lauterpacht, you see. So they were pretty well stocked. And so Kurt didn't have a college room. And, And he had the room in the Squire, and as you know, he virtually lived there all day long. In the same way that he did here, you know.
Yes,
he became a living legend. Yes. When I came up.
He'd been here since 1934. That is a long time.
Yes. And he kept that car for most of those years, the blue Armstrong Sidley one. Yes. He used to tell me about what they'd done before the war.
When you say
it was a rather different quirk before the war. I mean, and Glamour Williams, they went off together in the car, sort of touring in Europe.
Really?
Oh, yes, but that was him, yes. I never got to the bottom of exactly what happened there, after the war, he would take the Armstrong Sidley touring down to go to conferences. I remember he once took Geoffrey Wilson all the way down to a conference in northern Italy.
Good heavens.
That was Kurt. Kurt's hard part from Sidley. What was it? It belonged to, Campbell, I think, hadn't it? The chapel of the racing Campbell, who was killed on the motor speed record, water speed record.
Yes. He bought the car from
him? I think so, but I'm not very good on it, as it were. But he kept that car going for many, many years. That was long before Kurt became a fellow of Kurt became a fellow at Trinity Clare, where Bill Widerman left. Bill had gone from I went from Queens to Keys, and Bill Widerman went from Queens to Clare, as it were. Then of course Bill left for London. We go Colin, first of all, we had Kurt and Colin, of course, and Colin's still there. And Colin Turpin.
I was just going to say yes, that's right.
I lectured him, I never taught him, on the Roman law. He was one of those.
He'd been presumably a student from Johannesburg.
Yes, that's right, yes. He came up as a postgrad. In the same way that Bob Hipple later came up,
somewhat more dramatic.
There was still very much a sort of link. There was the Roman Dutch law link, very much so, with South Africa.
Yes.
Many of the South African judges and chief justices had been to Keir College at Cambridge. The chief justice family, had been, at Keys, in fact, long before my time. But Arnold McNair and Emily Wade knew them well.
Mr. Pritchard, I wandered off.
It's only taken us to 60.
Yes.
There's a lot to come.
Absolutely. Period, did you ever come across or have anything to do with Hirsch Lauterpacht?
When I said Lauterpacht would come down, that was Hirsch, I was thinking of. Oh. Ellie was largely off down in London by that time, very largely in London. Hirsch was in room 6. And when I said going back, he was in international law, which was one of the subjects I never studied. We didn't do it at King's London, at London University. It was one of the options, but only a third year option. International law hadn't really spread. We were still very much 45, 46. But up here, yes. I always saw him almost every day in the Squire. He would come in, he was always punctiliously in by about 11 o'clock. I didn't say he started work, but he would meet, and the students would be there for a couple of hours beforehand, sitting outside on their old desks, and he would turn up and he'd see them one by one. He was very much, as a research supervisor, he must have been a bit formidable, because he knew so much, but he knew what he wanted from his students, and he got it, as it were, and they were very good.
Yes.
But he was always extremely polite and friendly, and he took a great part in in as it were, for the faculty. He didn't shirk his side of faculty work. He would always come down and talk in the faculty.
Yes.
Which was very helpful in the 50s and 60s because we got quite a lot of people, with America having a rather more money than anybody else and things, and we would tend to have them over from Harvard and places like that, and one of the ones obviously they would know would be her.
I do remember some of the good-heart incumbents commenting on the fact that how decentralized the faculty is for a visitor. I mean, there isn't, you know, there isn't...
What now?
Yes. In contrast to earlier times, I'm just saying people like Hirsch would have been very attractive to visitors.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, visitors or, you know... They would come. We'd see most of them during the day. There were rather fewer visitors. The colleges hadn't got so many individual things. The Goodhart Professorship had not been set up, of course. But visitors would normally be on a short stay or something, or coming for lecture. They'd all come to the faculty.
Right.
Oh yes, yes. I mean, we'd meet most of them at things like tea in the morning.
Yes.
And, oh yes, I remember meeting lots of them then. That was before the Goodhart Professorship was set up in the...
Yes.
When was that? The late 60s, wasn't it? I mean, the first Goodhart Professors. In fact, later than that, I think the 70s.
Yes.
In the 60s, if we had people over, they would be Pitt Professors, which we had to share with economics and with history. But we had, as it were, a one-third share in the Pitt. I mustn't waste time, but it was always outraged me that the faculty was very weak-kneed, and when it got the Goodhart Professorship, it allowed economics, the economics representative of the general board to, and no doubt with the history of it, to suggest that, and get it through the general board, that since the law faculty now had its own visiting professorship, it didn't need part of the Pitt Professorship. And therefore we lost our third, and I'm afraid the faculty, I wasn't on it, I mean I would have thought it tooth and nail, that was in the because of course Goodhart had given us an extra chair, and there was no question we should have had that, and as well as the Pitt, the Goodhart Professorship was, as it were, entirely funded by Arthur Goodhart, and he didn't intend it to release the Pitt Professorship. But we had some very good Pitt professors over, very good ones, who particularly Harvard and the rest.
It is a shame.
And I don't think we get Pitt professors now in law. Well, we don't, in fact. We get Goodhart, and far be it from me to tell you, but, you know, we get a superb Goodhart professor. Excellent. Doing some, you know, come back to Keys. But poor Finn, for instance.
Yes.
Sorry, yes, but oh no, it was pretty family type between the 50s to the 60s.
And the
60s is a bit different, I'll talk about them in a moment, yes.
Someone else who springs to mind whom people ask about was Henry Barnes.
Oh yes, yes, I knew Henry Barnes. Yes, I knew, and Mrs. Barnes too. Yes, he was quite a character. He and Ashton Cross were the characters of the faculty. Henry had ceased to be by that time, as it were, an officer, a teaching officer of Jesus, but he did supervise, and he was a very popular supervisor in criminal law, and a very generous host too. When Dorothy and myself got engaged, he invited us round to lunch and in his rooms, because he used to live in his rooms above, in Sydney Street, very roughly above where Sainsbury's, Sainsbury's moved, but where Sainsbury's used to be a little bit further down in Sydney Street, opposite Sydney College. And I remember having a superb lunch with him, being offered the most superb wines, because he still was a remarkable judge of wine. Even though he wouldn't touch a drop, not by the time. Earlier memories, he had not been quite so abstemious.
Yes.
But in fact, he became a complete teetotaler, as it were. Yes. But he was very much, one of the characters for undergraduates. Stories about being president of Mexico for a couple of days, sort of approach. Yes.
And people used to flock to his lectures, apparently.
Yes, yes, they did. Not necessarily for the right reasons, but yes, no, he, yes, he was. Arthur Armitage took over the criminal law from him, and he was also very lively, but in a totally different way. But that was before Glanville came back, of course.
Mr. Pritchard, let me ask you, are you happy to continue, or shall we...
I mean, it's up to you. Oh,
we've spoken...
Oh, gosh, we've gone far too long.
Yes. Hour and a half.
Yes. I mean, I must be going on far too long for you.
Oh, no. But there are many...
The 60s, 70s were really very largely just worn your head, as it were, I was dragged in for two sessions as secretary, and secretaryship then was 3 years long. And at the end of the first session, so that was about 61 to about 64, 5, 62 to 65, I took leave of absence, and Tony took over for a leave, but he couldn't stand the job.
Tony Weir?
Tony Jolovich. Tony Jolovich.
Right.
Poppy helped him, as it were. He quite rightly didn't like the job at all. And so the faculty dragged me back for another 3 years to try and initiate, or rather help and teach the new... By that time the job had got so much that they decided they must have a faculty assistant, you see. You might see somebody more in the nature of Kirsty Allen we got a retired lieutenant colonel, and they needed somebody to teach. So I had 6 years as secretary. I don't think anybody else has ever had quite as long. And it was not. I mean, it was a happy period from the point of view, but it was a fraught and frenetic period for the 60s. From the point of view, but it's too late, I'm afraid, for me to tell you now at this stage.
Oh, I look forward to
that. Was the battle, battle with the old schools about the history, where we should be.
I would love to hear about that.
And also setting up Institute of Criminology and things. And that was, it was an exhausting period of time, I have to say, because I don't pay people, I quite rightly say this, the job of the secretary is terrible these days, I'm sure it is a nasty job, but in those days it was. Just to show you that we had to make the tax returns to the Inland Revenue, sign the P45s each year, for everybody in the faculty we had paid. And I still remember, you finished your examining, you finished your supervising in the Lent term, and you made your P45s. There weren't all that many of them, but we made the returns, we paid the checks I better leave the secretaryship, which is, I suppose, because I know there'll be tributes to before me, but Mickey Dyers and John Thornley, but I think I ought to leave that. But that was the period of the 60 to 70. The trouble was, it ended in chaos of the 68 student sit-ins and things.
Yes.
And the faculty, the as it were, the law school building was never the same after that.
Right.
Bit by bit, we lost out room after room of the old, so the 60s of from 70 to 80 was very largely a war of attrition in which the old schools took over more and more of the faculty. But in return, of course, we did at least get the downstairs Seeley Library. And also, too, the 60s, I should go back to the 60s, just as we needed a full-time professional assistant, but he didn't last. Very good man, Farrow, but he didn't last very long. So we needed for the first time in the 60s a professional librarian. Previously, Ellis Lewis had done it, you see, all these jobs were done by members of the family until the mid-60s. But then, of course, Willie Steiner came, and after him, the series Gordon Hughes, and then Will Major, and then finally David Wills and people. But before that, it just fell. The secretary of the faculty also had to act as secretary of the degree committee and liaise with the Institute of Criminology, which was not very easy at that 60s period.
No.
But that 60s-70, which as I say was a fairly frenetic period, 70 to 80 was a slightly different one. 80 to 90 was a bit different one too, when I came back for the faculty to help them computerize the examinations. But again, I'll have to leave that one.
Yes.
There's quite a tale behind that. But I'm only really just qualified, tell you about the faculty. The links with the faculty have been rather long and detailed.
Yes.
But they may be of some help to people.
Thank you so much, Mr. Pritchard, for truly fascinating.
But I'm for you. A great list for more.